by inch, row by row. Gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground.
This is the Manic Gardener, home of all things about sustainable and organic gardening, and today we're going to look at a method that does not even require fertile ground.
Till the rains come tumbling down.
This week's gardening tip, brief but good, appears at the end of the show as usual, and don't forget to check themanicgardener.com for the links associated with this podcast. There are a number of really excellent websites that you should be aware of, and they'll all be listed there. I'm going to be speaking with two practitioners of an organic gardening movement that truly does aim not just to reform gardening practices, but to change the world. There are some of us who may backpedal when we're charged with being overly moralistic about organics, rather like Captain Barbossa in Pirates of the Caribbean, who claimed that the code of the pirates was more of what you'd call guidelines. Well, you won't find people who practice permaculture beating such a retreat. They will stand firm. Gardening and landscaping are just part of this, I don't know whether to call it a movement or a philosophy, because it's both. We'll talk with Jerome Owatowski, who has a tropical greenhouse at 7,200 feet in the Rocky Mountains north of Aspen, Colorado. He has studied with some of permaculture's founders and has been active in the group for close to a quarter century now. He publishes in Permaculture Activist magazine, has a monthly radio program on kdnk.org. His show is The Living Permaculture Show. His website is the Colorado Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute. He holds workshops and seminars both there and all around the world. Karine Erba is newer to the practice, but extraordinarily experienced and knowledgeable, so much so that she would be intimidating if she weren't also so personable. She trained in Australia, the home of permaculture, at one of the premier institutes there, and she has studied in India with Vandana Shiva. It's a good thing I didn't know that when I met her. I hadn't put the name together with the person. Because if I had known, I would probably have been trying to kiss Karine's feet, and I would have been too awed to speak. Vandana Shiva is, if you don't know that name, write it down, Vandana Shiva. She is a powerhouse, and if anybody manages to bring down Monsanto, or I will try to be more measured here, to curb some of Monsanto's excesses, my bets are on her. Based now in Bozeman, Montana, Karine has been leading seminars, has just conducted the city's first PermaBlitz, and is active in numerous other ways. Her website is brokengroundpermaculture.com. Sorry, I got a little carried away there. Now to visit Jerome. I'm with Jerome Owatowski, the founder and director of the Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute in Basalt Mountain in Colorado, correct?
Basalt Mountain.
Okay then. So could you give us a quick definition of permaculture, which I had never heard of until I stumbled, I think, on your site?
Is that right? How obscure the movement is there in Montana. Okay, well, you know, permaculture is a design system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a collection of traditional practices with some new design strategies that looks at whole systems approach.
What does that mean?
If you are taking your backyard, for an example, or here at Crimpy, we're tucked into a pinyon and juniper forest. And we have, there's energy coming into the site, energy of all kinds. There's wind, there's sun, there's rain, snow. Uh-huh. And the idea is to capture that energy.
And use that to run your system?
Yes, to run your system. And there are ways of, when we build soils by capturing energy, we design our gardens so that they are perennial and they're not as energy consumptive. We put solar panels on our roof. We put hot water panels on our roof. We gutter all our roofs so we catch all of the energy.
You catch all the water?
Yes, and we recycle that into tanks and then use gravity flow to water our gardens and greenhouses. We use solar for pumping. We use gravity for distributing water. So we just look at the potentials for moving and storing energy. That's just one part of permaculture.
Are you actually off the grid, the electric grid?
We don't pay electric bill, but we're not off the grid.
You don't pay electric bills?
No.
We have. That's wonderful.
Anybody can do that if they go buy a PV system. We have a 6.3 kilowatt power plant on our roof.
Uh-huh.
It's just put in a few months ago because of all the stimulus packages right now and all the tax rebates.
Good timing.
Yeah, good timing. So we do have electric bill, but it's $15 a month. It's just a fee that we have to pay to our utility people and some taxes. But we generate enough electricity to run our whole operation with the PVs we have on there.
PVs?
And we don't photovoltaic panels. Before I had my PV system installed about 5 months ago, my average bill was only $60. A month, and that ran my whole facility.
That's not just your home, that's the whole institute.
Everything. The institute, we have an apartment, we have a house, a cabin, a teaching facility, we have four greenhouses.
Heavens.
Again, using our roof not only to catch water, but to store our PV panels and to mount them there. Our house is also passive solar.
Explain that.
That's another thing that's been swept under the rugs. Passive solar design.
This means allowing natural sunlight to heat your home?
Yes, and to store it into thermal mass.
How do you do that?
With a huge stone wall.
Isn't that a problem in the summer?
No, because the sun angle changes.
Uh-huh.
And it cools the house in the summer.
So the sun does not reach that wall in summer.
Mm-hmm. It's by design. It's called an overhang.
Uh-huh.
And I have a passion fruit vine in my greenhouse so that the sun doesn't reach my patio in the greenhouse. And I have a passion fruit that grows 40 feet in one direction and 20 feet out in another direction. And it covers my patio and shades all my thermal mass during the summer. So it's a cool room in the summer. And then we cut all that back and harvest the passion fruit. And then allow the sun to come in at a lower angle.
Right.
Warm all of those thermal mass surfaces.
In the winter.
Yes, and then we have a climate battery that pumps the hot air into the soil profile and heat it down to 5 feet. And that can radiate back up, or we pump it back out with another thermostat at 50 degrees and warm the greenhouse at night.
That sounds very energy intensive.
No. Small fans. Mm-hmm. 90-watt fans, that three of them can do all of the work for a 72-foot greenhouse.
So a lot of it's in the design.
Yeah, well, that too. But, you know, we don't use very much energy, and we generate all our electricity anyway. So then at night, the thermostat can kick back on at 50 degrees and put 60-degree air back into the greenhouse from the soil. And then when that doesn't quite work at, say, 5 degrees above zero, we have a sauna that's attached to the greenhouse. And so we take a sauna.
A sauna,
wood-burning sauna.
Okay.
It's a big one. It's like a big bunker.
Uh-huh.
It's like walking inside a masonry stove, taking a sauna, and then you open the door that's adjacent, connected to the greenhouse, and you heat the greenhouse for 24 hours. So that's another way. So we do not have to use any backup heating other than the sauna. And we design commercial greenhouses with different backup heating systems, wood burning stoves, pellet stoves, sometimes propane. But we don't use very much backup, only on the coldest nights when it starts to drop to zero and, 10, 20
and below.
So we have to protect for that eventuality, but we don't have to turn the propane heater on, every night like most greenhouses.
Uh-huh. What have you planted? You've got apricot trees, apple trees, plum trees.
Over 150 varieties. So we have 20 different kinds of apples. 10 different kinds of apricots and 10 different kinds of pears, 10 different kinds of plums, 20 different kinds of grapes, all fruiting at this elevation because they're all hardy to 20 below zero. Those are just the outside things. We have Asian pears, filberts.
Outside?
Outside, yeah. And then inside we have four greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
One is tropical. So we have passion fruit and papaya and banana.
Oh, no. You're kidding.
Well, so basically we created a Garden of Eden here. In our greenhouses, we grow polycultures.
What does that mean?
Well, that means we don't grow annuals per se. We have a small amount of annuals, and we have about two-thirds of our garden and our greenhouses, or maybe more than that, is perennial.
Perennials. Now, when most people think about planting a garden, they think almost exclusively in terms of annuals. But
right.
You're talking about setting up a much larger permanent structure and then fitting in annuals in amongst those trees and shrubs. Is that right?
That. And then you always have maybe a few beds that are annuals. You can always have, 10% annuals. That's what we need here. Like I said, I'd rather do the perennials. I can always trade or buy annual produce organically. We find it easier to grow figs and bananas and passion fruit and papayas, but there are certain things we just don't have enough room for, or we don't want to grow them. They're too boring. So
you grow plenty of other interesting things. Now, you said you have four greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference amongst them? Why four? Just more space?
No, they all designed to grow a different climate zone.
Okay.
The attached greenhouse that's onto our house is 24 by 35, and it has a big fig tree in it, plus rosemary and pomegranates, and a bunch of other plants in there as well, annuals, perennials. But it's a fig forest. So you walk down the stairwell, go off onto a landing down to some steps down into a fig forest. And we have 5 months of fig season. That does not have to be heated other than the house heats it somewhat. It goes dormant. So there's no additional heat for that.
Uh-huh.
And the greenhouse heats the house several months out of the year.
Ah, because it's a very big reservoir of passive solar heat.
Yeah, then we have a tropical greenhouse that we can grow tropical plants in, and that has the climate battery and the sauna and all the thermal mass that heats that.
That needs to be kept warm all the time.
Well, that needs to be kept above 40 degrees in the wintertime at 9. And that we can do that without a propane heater. We can do that just with, like I said, sauna,
right?
Underground heating system, active, passive, thermal storage. Then we have some other greenhouses that are more like season extenders. We can grow 9 months out of the year.
Uh-huh.
So we have some temperate, where we just grow winter greens, or we just leave it fallow for the winter and grow worms in it, or we grow summer. We have a lot of summer vegetables in there, eggplants, tomatoes, and peppers, and we use it for our nursery as well. So we have four different greenhouses. We use them differently and shut them down, differently because they're not necessary.
Now, when you say worm farms, what do you mean?
Well, you can grow worms a lot of different ways. You can take some 15-gallon buckets and put in some leaves and some manure and some worms or your kitchen garbage, and you can put some leaves on top of that and just stack those three high, and you can grow worms in there.
Uh-huh.
You can do that in a bed, or you can do it in your walkways.
Uh-huh.
And so in our walkways, rather than just walking on dirt, we put about 4 inches of organic matter down. And then we put a pallet down, put some old plywood on top of that.
So that the walkway is raised above the earth. The earth is not being constantly compressed.
Right. And then we're growing worms under there. So every 3 months we can lift those pallets up, dig out that material that's already digested by the worms, and use it in our greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And then we reintroduce the organic matter, whether it's leaves or rotten manure or whatever, wet it down, put more worms in there, and grow that all over again.
And then you put the walkway back down.
Yeah. And then we also put a row of bedding plants, 5 gallon pots of citrus and bananas and papayas. So it also becomes a nursery space. It's a worm farm. It's a walkway. And I also have my archery range there. So I have a 72 foot archery range that I shoot over my nursery and in between. So I put a fig leaf on my archery range way down 72 feet, and I can shoot there. So I have 4 functions in my pathway.
Uh-huh. Talk about multiple use.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Everything in permaculture gardens, everything has multiple functions. We have one huge terrace above our pond that gets double sun. So it's like North Carolina.
Double sun meaning the reflected warmth and light from the pond itself, as well as what's coming through the air?
Onto the rock walls, the huge stones. We have 4 foot stone, massive stone terraces of basalt rock. And so those things get really warm, and they moderate the climate for a month on either side.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is the water also moderates the climate. And we have aquaculture in there. We have tilapia, carp, crayfish, ducks. And we can use that water as a nutrient-rich fertilizer and foliar feed.
Oh.
You know, everything gardens.
Right.
That's kind of the center for all our beneficial insects and the birds and bats and swallows and dragonflies all use that as their base, for their watering hole.
Right.
Bees. And we have big lily pads on it. So it actually cools. Lilies cool the pond in the summer.
Do you want that?
Yeah. So the pond doesn't overheat.
Mm-hmm.
Lily pads, you know, gives you a whole different dimension in the pond's beauty, plus all the algae that grows on there are good for the fish, and they scrub the lily pads from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And the ducks, we have a couple of ducks in there that have been respectful of the lily pads this year. They haven't eaten the lilies.
Uh-huh.
They've eaten all the duckweed, but they haven't. And they eat comfrey, so we throw comfrey in the pond,
mm-hmm.
and a bit of scratch, and they're happy.
This sounds fairly labor intensive. You're doing all of this work by hand, right? No large machinery.
No, it is less labor intensive as time goes on.
Why?
We have to mulch a couple of times a year, and we pull all our weeds and cut all our different things that we don't need. A lot of hollyhocks, a lot of horseradish, a lot of Siberian pea shrub, and all of the nitrogen fixing. It's a coppice thing. We coppice it and feed it to the animals.
What is coppice?
I mean cut back.
Okay.
Prune.
Right.
And that is a sustainable way of getting free animal fodder.
Uh-huh.
And then we use their manure back into the garden and greenhouse.
Right.
And we get their meat and eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And their manure and whatever thing. And then that way we don't have to pay for a lot of feed, and we keep our numbers down. We have rabbits and goats that we harvest, chickens, eggs. And we all have some other things. We have fish that we harvest. We don't harvest the ducks. We only have 2 ducks.
Uh-huh.
So again, these are traditional models. If you go to Nepal, there'll be a 2-acre farm, and that's what they do, is they use the forest sustainably to feed their animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have small crop fields. They have integrated mustards and wheat and sometimes rice. All of the residues are recycled into a couple of cows or an oxen and goats, and then they put all that stuff back in. So we're looking at that model.
Right.
And well, if we want, we can go out and get other stuff. We can go down to the creek and cut willows, and we can feed them to the goats and rabbits and stuff. You know, if somebody cuts a tree down, you can take that whole tree and feed it to the goats.
Right, right. So you know, it's making use of what's available.
Exactly. Yes. And now we've done that, and now we almost have a closed system on 1 acre.
That's what it sounds like.
In the distant past, Jerome sold much of what he produces, but now he gives it away to people who come for tours and uses much of the rest to feed himself and his staff and the people who sometimes spend several weeks or several days on site for various types of seminars.
The Mediterranean greenhouse now, there's probably a bushel of figs in there. They're ripening very slowly, which is kind of nice because I have tours. And when I do our tours, we like to feed people as we go along and talk about the different guilds. So they always get some figs, they get maybe a passion fruit, and they get all the plums and grapes and apples that are ripe at that time, and berries, whatever. We freeze a lot of stuff. We just made a big bunch of applesauce. We've made pesto. We canned pickles. We process a lot of stuff here and even teach canning workshops here and offsite.
Jerome, who's doing all this work? How many people have you got there?
My staff and interns.
How many people is that?
Well, I have about 4 people living here right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes from anywhere from 4 to 7.
And that 4 to 7 people is enough to do all of this different, all this work?
And to run 3 businesses.
Oh.
Basically, We have this livelihood program that we're developing here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's counter to capitalism, because capitalism is a crumbling system right now, as you know.
I've had my suspicions.
Yeah, and so we're trying to create these livelihoods that are more labor intensive, but not so capital intensive. We're using what we have here to generate income and resources. So we have the educational thing. So we put on the design course, we put on a half a dozen workshops, and some 2-day, 1-day, 4-day. We've just had our 4-day intensive greenhouse and workshop, and we had people from all over the world coming.
It's wonderful. So the livelihood program is something where you are trying to not just move people into permaculture, but educate them about sort of alternatives to our capitalist, consumerist society?
To create a sustainable business model. You know, the environment is impacted by our capitalist system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we tax the environment enormously.
Uh-huh.
Our overuse of energy, we see all of the examples of this fracking of gas that totally destroys the environment just to get the last bit of gas out. We see this business of the tar sands, these 2 big examples, and then we see the oil spill, 3 examples of how we impact the environment just to keep going with fossil fuels.
The Alberta oil sands that you're talking about. Yeah.
So the livelihood program is, we have 3 livelihoods or 4 livelihoods we're creating here. One's educational, and that one is the most active right now. We can generate quite a bit of income to run our operations and do all our educational outreach as a nonprofit. Then we have a consulting business where we do, it's a for-profit, it's an S-Corp.
Hang on, you said you had 4 livelihood programs. The first is education, the second was consulting.
One is in consulting. The other one is a woodworking workshop
where
we can build trellises, beehives, worm boxes, solar dryers, all from beetle kill wood.
And you're talking here about wood that's been killed by the white pine beetle.
Yeah, so we take those logs, we mill them here, and we build everything we need from a resource that's a trash, you know, because they don't know what to do with the trees here.
And what's the fourth one?
That's the fourth one. Well, the other one is herbs and nursery.
So when you're talking about livelihood program, you're talking about teaching people ways that they can make a living in the real world, but that somehow doesn't damage that world.
Exactly.
Jerome, we're about out of time here. Is there something important I forgot to ask you?
Well, we need to break out of this traditional mindset of the annual gardens and what the extension people are doing, and we need to broaden our perspective into doing perennial polycultures, and it makes life a lot easier. I mean, everybody has a backyard. Let's just fill it full of edible landscaping.
That's what I've been working at. It was wonderful to discover this because I finally had a name for what I've been trying to do in my backyard.
All these pieces are out there. We can draw from all of those people who are brilliant, and let's design a system that has all of those things
and
together.
And that is more self-sustaining.
Exactly.
Understood.
But this model of taking all of these techniques
and integrating
that work, yes, and that's what permaculture is all about, is sustainable design.
I want to thank you again for joining us and for everything that you've contributed to this.
Right, and this is the new revolution.
Yeah. Yeah. It's small scale, it's sustainable, and it can be done anywhere because it's designed largely with the particular site in mind.
Right. All right. Thank you for having me on. And maybe
that was Jerome Owatowski, whose website, affectionately known as Crimpy, the Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, has an absolute wealth of information, films, photographs, links to other sites, blog, you name it. Do check it out. I will be putting up a post on my site, themanicgardener.com, that will contain links to a number of the sources that he mentioned. Some you heard, some you did not. So check it out. Onwards now to our second guest for the day, Karine Irby, who is doing permaculture right here on the ground in Bozeman, Montana. She explained a good deal about the philosophy of permaculture, which is much more than just a set of guidelines, but amounts really to an entire ethics. A couple of days later, I got to see her actually doing a bit of permaculture landscaping. But we started off in my yard, where she turned a permaculturist's eye on my gardening. Right now, I'm with Karine Irby.
Karine Irby.
Okay, I got them both wrong. Good.
That's very
okay,
cool.
That's over. Okay, Karine Irby of Broken Ground, a permaculture company here in Bozeman, Montana.
Right, yeah, permaculture education and edible garden design business.
Good, and that's what I'm interested in. I hate to think of myself as horribly practical, but I realize that I've gotten to the point where I want to be able to eat practically everything that's in my garden.
Right, and so, that's very much what permaculture is that it's actually the lowest priority for permaculture is aesthetic. Right, and that everything that you put in your garden should be functional in some way, whether it's edible, whether it's medicinal, whether it repels insects, whether it attracts beneficial insects.
Right.
So you don't put anything in your garden that's simply ornamental.
That's just pretty.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's nice if it's pretty also.
Right, it is. And it usually is.
Right. Well, it's interesting. When I was speaking with Jerome, he's got this whole institute.
Mm-hmm.
And they are doing things with solar panels and recycling their gray water, all kinds of things to try to reduce their impact, to reduce their, they sell electricity instead of using it from the grid.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sees that all of those things also as part of permaculture.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's about living in a closed loop system as much as possible. So as much of your waste that you can turn back into a resource, and about capturing and storing energy as much as possible on your site before it leaves your site. So he's trying to permaculture is meeting all of your food, energy, and shelter needs in a sustainable fashion.
Right. It's not just the one, and they feed into each other,
right,
in fact.
Exactly.
And support each other.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So here, you know, from what you've done with this patio in terms of, because permaculture a lot is about rainwater harvesting.
Okay.
So the fact that, and one of the best places to store your water is in the soil.
And in this case, I used to have a flat piece of gray cement, which I hated because it was ugly, but also it didn't let any rainwater through to the soil,
right,
which meant the soil was without any sort of nourishment. It wouldn't have been able to support even worm life.
Right.
And we broke it up and then reset the pieces, but with space between them, where I'm gradually getting some ground cover in. And that means that It can absorb water.
It can absorb more water, and also if you're putting in something like thyme, as you walk on the patio, you're going to scuff up the thyme, and that's going to be, you know, leave a scent that could potentially repel insects. So it's kind of as you're trying to, permaculture is also about observing and designing consciously so that you can actually minimize your work. So
I like that.
In taking, you know, and coming out of your door here and going over to get to harvest some carrots that you have over there.
Right.
And if there's time in the way and you're scuffing it up and you say you have a bunch of stuff that's growing here, that it might act as an insect repellent without you doing any real work, because you're going to go over to harvest the carrots anyway, but
right.
You might as well be doing something else
right.
as well.
Okay. Well, and so. I didn't even realize that. I feel much smarter than
right.
I have
exactly.
any right to
think. Well, and that's something that they say about permaculture. A lot of it is common sense, right? You put your washing line in an area that's south-facing, that's sun-facing,
yeah.
that might be where you've noticed the wind comes from as well, because that's going to dry your clothes that much
right.
quicker. You obviously put, you know, your greenhouse on the south-facing side, or you put your vegetable garden in a sun-facing area. They're all common sense things that we do,
right?
But permaculture kind of integrates it all into a conscious design
right.
of all
right.
of those things.
Yeah. So when we took out the cement patio mm-hmm. and I fear a large tree that used to provide shade for us here on the patio, we put in several fruit trees.
Great.
And I chose the two on the south, a pear tree a little bit further east and a plum. I was hoping that would mean that eventually when they get larger, we'll be able to put they will provide the shade for the picnic table.
Great.
At this point, we've got a little wooden structure with some burlap over it.
Nice. And are you going to grow up?
I would like
this?
To do that also, but
right.
But we haven't done that yet. Yeah, it would make a great place for grapes.
Mm-hmm.
It's got lots of sun.
Right. So, and that's another principle of permaculture, is this idea that for every element that you have in your system, it should perform multiple functions.
Right. So this one would perform not only shade, but also act as
a trellis.
Right.
Right.
For something you'd eat.
Exactly.
Scarlet runner beans.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Which have those amazing, beautiful blossoms, which attract hummingbirds. And
there you go.
Which are edible.
You got it.
As well as the beans. No, that's not so. But I do have beans here amongst these strawberries. And but this strawberry patch didn't do all that well this year. I'm not sure why.
Right.
These are relatively new, and I have
and
been...
Those, okay.
Yeah, and I've been wondering... This one I've cut. But I've been wondering whether they are... getting sapped
yeah.
by that tree. That's my suspicion. Well, there's that. But the thing that
and
I find...
nutrients, you mean?
Yeah. So I've got, you know, your ordinary, June-bearing strawberries here, and then I have some ever-bearing down there.
Right.
I bought 60 of those plants. I put 20 of them there, 20 of them next door,
oh,
and
wow.
20 of them across the alley.
Right.
And I'll show you all three plots.
Yeah.
And very
see the difference.
Interesting.
Interesting.
And it's not light.
That's what's interesting, too, is another, you know, big principle of permaculture is observing and interacting. It's actually cool that we're here while it's raining, because one of the things that permaculture asks is that when you get to a site, or your site and your property, and you want to design it in a permaculture fashion, is to observe what's going on, observe where water flows on
I
your
know.
Site. You don't
so.
Have...
No.
Oh, you don't have gutters on the top.
No,
of
there are no
on
gutters
the
there.
Side.
We're not catching any of our water. Don't even ask. It's a disaster. We're bad.
No. You're not as bad as many. You're growing a lot of your food. So
the garden tour lasted a good half hour, but I'll spare you most of that. Eventually, we did go inside and started talking more about permaculture, and some of this got very interesting because permaculture did not do everything that I expected it to do. It is not in accord with other movements that I just assumed it would be aligned with.
So one of the things that interested me mm-hmm. when I was talking with Jerome this morning, well, when I was also just doing the research on it also, was the extent to which permaculture is not about native species, for instance.
Right.
So that the folks in the Parks and Rec Department here hate the carragana.
Right.
It's invasive.
Right.
You know, and they would never be proud of a Russian olive tree for
mm-hmm.
the same reasons.
But those things might be part of a permaculture planting.
Absolutely, because, you know, they serve a function. They're right. Either fixing nitrogen. Well, in both cases, those two plants are fixing nitrogen.
Russian olive fixes nitrogen? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and carrigana, of course, is a good windbreak, like I said, out mm-hmm. there. So,
and it's a legume.
Yes.
Right, and that's why it fixes nitrogen, because it's a member of that family.
Right. If the plant serves a function that could help in some way make your garden or your property more productive in some way, then they will use those plants. A lot of permaculturalists who are hardcore permaculturalists actually don't even mind introducing new species. I wouldn't necessarily go that far.
Yeah, that bothers me a little bit, because mm-hmm. I feel as though, okay, well, it might be great in your yard, but mm-hmm. the carrigana is going to spread.
Sure.
Those things seed like crazy.
Right.
And then you're hurting the ecosystem and your neighbors.
Right.
And that doesn't seem like a very good practice.
Well, and I think that for the carrigana, for example, what it could do is it's not only a nitrogen fixer and a windbreak, but if you had to take it down, if you had to chop it down, then you chop that down and leave that in the soil, and that's more nitrogen for the soil, mm-hmm. right? So that you find other functions for it. There's a big thing in permaculture called the problem is the solution. It's inherent in observing and interacting with nature, so that if you're looking at your property and you observe things, you want to observe them without a judgmental eye, because a problem that you immediately judge as a problem may actually have a solution. So Bill Mollison, who's the co-originator of permaculture,
and he's Australian, right?
And he's Australian. Mm-hmm. Both Bill Mollison and David Holmgren, who coined that term mm-hmm. and who came up with this integrated design science, were from Australia, and they coined it in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And Bill Mollison, came up with this thing: the problem is the solution. That it's not that there are so many slugs in your garden; it's that there aren't enough ducks.
Ah.
So that it's not that you have so many weeds in your garden, it's that you haven't planted what you want to plant.
Or you haven't planted densely enough.
Exactly. So, you know, it's not that there are so many lawns in the suburbs, it's that there aren't enough gardens. You know, looking at what you think is a problem and turning it into a solution. It's not that there's so much water that accumulates in that place, it's that you haven't put in... You haven't dug an infiltration basin to take advantage of that water.
Or you haven't planted the mm-hmm. water-loving plants there.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's really considering things in a different light mm-hmm. and trying to... Permaculture is about working with nature, not mm-hmm. against it. And
right.
So trying to look at nature, mimic nature, and also harmonize with the patterns that you see.
Okay. So I think it's 5... major spruce trees on the east and southeast corner of my house. I wish there were not so many.
Right.
I can't grow anything there of any significance.
Right.
And, but I did discover that I can harvest the duff. Mm-hmm. And I use that as one of my major soil amendments now.
Right.
I don't rake under those trees. I never want to take all the duff away, because it supports a very important layer of organisms, in particular fungal organisms that the trees need.
Right.
But I will take some of it away in mm-hmm. patches.
Mm-hmm. So there you have what a lot of people would say is a problem, and you've turned it into a resource. You've turned it into a solution for another part of your garden. And so that's also... You know, an argument in permaculture is that there is no waste in a permaculturally designed system.
Mm-hmm.
There's waste in a system that's out of scale, like a city or a feedlot, because they haven't found a way to use that resource.
Right.
You know, waste is a resource that just hasn't been used and put back into the system.
Why do you say a feedlot is a waste?
What is manure in a feedlot, mm-hmm. you know, that could be a resource mm-hmm. on your land in a farm
mm-hmm.
becomes a waste product because the system there is out of scale. There are too many cows, too much cattle in one place.
Right.
So it's creating what is normally a resource, and it's creating it into a waste, because then they have to deal with that scale. Of manure, rather than if you only had a few cows on your property and they produced manure for you.
And that's they were allowed to roam.
And they were allowed to roam.
And spread the manure around.
Right. Then then you have a resource that's right. fertility back into your system.
Right.
But in a system where you have 500 cattle in one place,
then the manure is a problem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it's that same kind of thing where, you know, permaculture is about small scale intensive systems for the
right.
most part.
Right.
Arguing that our cities are out of scale, our economy is out of scale, our agriculture is out of scale. So that if we can scale things back
down,
that we wouldn't have to deal with a lot of the environmental problems, pollution problems that we have.
Right. Stephen?
Hi.
This is Karine.
Oh, sorry, I hope I'm not interrupting.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
We're discussing permaculture.
So you're actually done with the
No, we're doing it right now.
You're going to have to cut all this out?
No, are you kidding? It'll be the high spot of the hour.
Okay, well, I was going to feed the cat, and then maybe I will do my business elsewhere.
Okay.
You're not done yet.
Okay. Sounds like an arrangement. Small scale. Okay, Jerome mm-hmm. gave up selling vegetables
mm-hmm.
because he said it didn't pay. He was put out of business twice, he said, and he just feels that the system, you know, is so unfriendly to small-scale producers that it wasn't worth it. And he had other ways to make his living.
Sure.
But, I mean, that seems to me that's one of the major problems with saying scale back. I mean, yes, I agree, everybody should scale back, but mm-hmm. everybody isn't going to instantly. And until they do, those who are trying to make it small scale are at an enormous disadvantage.
Right. Well, and a lot of permaculture, so permaculture is about, you know, landscape design, but it's also, there's a social permaculture component. And that's about going local.
Right.
You know, and supporting local and using barter and exchange, alternative methods of economic methods.
I see.
So a lot of that is looking at how we can organize people, networks of people.
So permaculture goes way beyond being a theory about how plants can grow or how gardens should be planted.
Right.
It is a social. It's a social theory. And economic.
It's a philosophy of life, a lot of people
right.
would say.
Okay.
And it's fundamental. There are three ethics that
okay.
are part of
what are those?
Permaculture. The first ethic is earth care. So
okay.
care of the earth, the soils, the
right.
forests, the rivers, and understanding that every living thing has an intrinsic worth.
Right.
Then care of people.
Okay.
So that would be that, you know, first and foremost, you're taking care of yourself and your family and your neighbors, you know,
mm-hmm.
that if there's something that is, you know, enslaving people or creating hardship for people, that's obviously not permaculture.
Okay.
But looking at different networks of how you set up and how you organize, how you get along. So that's the second ethic. And then the third ethic is something called fair share. And what the idea behind that is that there is a redistribution of surplus. So that you, if you have a surplus of veggies, if you have a surplus of time, if you have a surplus of resources,
mm-hmm.
manure, you know, whatever, that you feed that surplus back to the two first ethics. So you feed that surplus back to the earth,
mm-hmm.
or you feed that surplus back to
People.
To the people. So
right.
if you have a surplus of knowledge about organic gardening, you're feeding that back to the people by having a blog, right?
Uh-huh.
So if I have a
I learn as I go, actually.
Right, sure. But you still have that kind of idea.
Uh-huh.
If I have a surplus of knowledge about permaculture, I'm going to feed that back to the people. And
which is why I'm interviewing
that,
you.
Right.
Precisely.
So there's that social aspect to it. But coming back, and with the understanding that there's a limit to our consumption and growth, where we won't have a lot of surplus if we keep on growing,
right.
you know, indefinitely.
Right. Yeah.
But that there are ways through farmers markets or whatever to redistribute your surplus in whatever way possible.
In a way that's equitable and fair.
Right.
Right.
And
right.
those three ethics are kind of the foundation of permaculture, but they're probably things that you, having not known about permaculture, probably live by.
As much as I can.
Right. And then there's a set of principles, permaculture principles, that are more specific to permaculture.
To landscaping, you mean? Or to
not
what?
Necessarily to landscaping, because again, they can be applied to social permaculture as well. So there's the concept of observe and interact. You know, observe and interact with nature, mimic nature, harmonize with patterns. Mm-hmm. Observe and interact, you know, the relationships that you have with mm-hmm. people. Catch and store energy. Try to, you know, the sun that's coming onto the other side, the wind, the water, you want to figure out ways that you can catch and store,
yep.
set up an interception net on your property so that you use
right.
those that energy. You know, another principle is every element performs multiple functions,
mm-hmm.
right? So you have a chicken for its meat, its eggs, its feathers, the fact that it gives off heat. You know, all of those reasons. You don't just have it for one reason.
Right. And its droppings.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And its droppings.
Yep.
So the same could be applied to this wood stove here, where it's giving off heat, but it's heating the water at the same time. And if you hung a rope above here, you could...
To dry things.
You could dry things.
Right.
You know? So it's kind of in the way that you live as well. And then along the same lines... Each element performs multiple functions. Each function is supported by multiple elements.
Yes. So you really have a network.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, nothing stands alone.
Exactly. And that's what you want in permaculture, too, is you want a, you know, it's a design science where you're looking and wanting to design and maintain an agriculturally productive ecosystem that has the diversity and the resilience and the stability of natural ecosystems.
Right, which means it's got to be very varied.
Exactly.
The opposite of monoculture.
Exactly.
Right. You've got to have a lot of different interconnected pieces. They support each other, and that means that no one of them is incredibly vulnerable
right.
and can bring the whole system down. The too big to fail business.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, so you create a network. You know, just like if you think of a spider's web and looking at patterns in nature,
right.
you know, if you take one strand out of that spider's web, the spider's web is not going to collapse.
Right.
So it's how do you create enough networks, both on a social level within your community and on a landscape level on your property,
mm-hmm.
so that if one strand is taken away, the whole thing doesn't collapse.
Right.
And you can see, you know, on... why our economy is out of scale. They've put all their stake in, you know, this global economy, and, you know, you take one strand away and Wall Street collapses,
right.
you know, and there's a major crisis.
Right.
But it's that whole concept of if you're going to harvest water, try to do it five ways on your
right.
property.
Right.
So that if there is a drought, if one of those things is taken away and you can't, for whatever reason, harvest with
you have
it,
other
you have
sources.
Other options.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
And the same is true with, you know, organizing people, is that, you know, you create enough networks there that if one of them doesn't work out for you.
You have others.
You have others that you can rely on. It's the same as, you know, childcare is a perfect example.
You don't just have one
person that you rely on. You rely on, you know, five people. So
right.
that if, you know, so-and-so can't do it that one night, you have four other people that you can rely on.
Right.
So that's where, you know, the social permaculture and the landscape kind of design kind of connect, or the principles
mm-hmm.
apply.
Mm-hmm.
Or they apply in both contexts.
Yeah.
You know, permaculture as a movement has not focused as much on the social permaculture side,
mm-hmm.
which is unfortunate, because you can have the most beautiful permaculturally designed landscape, but if the people who are living there can't get along, then
right.
you know, what's it for?
What's it worth? Yeah.
Yeah, what's it worth?
One of the things that interests me, with this is back to the landscaping.
Yeah,
sure. One of the objections to buy local that I've heard now
mm-hmm.
multiple times
sure.
is, for instance, that, okay, if you're going to be buying tomatoes in Montana, to pick a state at random, and you're buying them in the winter, buying local means you're buying hothouse tomatoes.
Mm.
You're buying them from a greenhouse. The greenhouse has to be heated. It's probably being heated, you know, with petroleum.
Sure. Right.
And therefore, those tomatoes may, in fact, be less environmentally good than the ones that were shipped from California.
Right.
But what interests me about permaculture here is that, you know, Jerome certainly has greenhouses that are, well, they're really green.
Mm-hmm. Right, that don't have any petroleum inputs.
Virtually none.
Right.
He says that he does have a backup propane system.
Right.
But he very rarely has to use it.
Right.
So he is not using electricity from the grid.
Mm-hmm.
He is not using petroleum or oil products in order to heat his greenhouses.
Yeah, he's catching and storing the energy from the sun
and
from a renewable resource.
So if greenhouses in cold areas were all designed like this,
mm-hmm.
then it would make perfect sense to eat the most exotic fruits we wanted because they would still be local.
Well, I've often thought that if somebody had the capital or if I had the capital to be able to, you know, build one of those greenhouses or several of those greenhouses and you went into local production of avocados or mangoes or something like that, you'd probably make a lot of money in Montana doing that.
Right. Well, we're about out of time here,
mm-hmm.
so I want to thank you again.
Thank you.
Very much. And I'm looking forward to Saturday's Permablitz.
Right.
Could you just say a word about what that involves?
Basically, that involves a group of people getting together and doing a little bit of a makeover of a backyard in a permaculture fashion.
In one afternoon, am I right?
In one afternoon.
Okay.
So we'll see how much we get done.
So this Saturday, we're going to be directing a crew.
Right.
How big a backyard?
The space is, I would say, about 50 feet by 20. So it's not very big.
It's a backyard.
Yeah. And that's another permaculture concept is start small.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just this one area that we're going to put in a few keyhole garden beds and an herb spiral and basically sheet mulch it this fall so that it can overwinter and be ready to plant up in the spring.
Okay.
So,
well, I am going to be very interested to see it. I am afraid I probably won't be able to stay and help very much because I think I'm going to be covering my greenhouse.
Yeah, of course.
So I'll see you Saturday.
Come on Saturday.
I will. Saturday afternoon found me at the home of Kevin Blue and Ryan Morgan, where all the action, and there was a lot, was at the back of the generous backyard where a wall of maybe 3 feet high set off the terrace garden. Steps led up to a path that bisected the long plot, and all the permaculture work was being done on the southern, sunnier end of that plot. The afternoon blitz had been scheduled to end at 5, and by the time I got there at 4 or 4:30, there were already clearly marked rows running down the length of the long bed and some interesting structures at its northern end. So how much of this have you done today?
Pretty much everything.
What was here before? Compacted humps with what on them? Weeds?
The weeds had already been cut down.
I cut down the weeds like a month and a half ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, where these two beds are, they're
just these humps?
Humps, and then there were trenches.
Between them.
In between them.
Okay.
So then we leveled it out, and it was the same over there.
So you leveled it out, and then you put down cardboard?
We put down cardboard.
Because of the weeds?
Yeah.
And then what's directly on top of the cardboard? A layer of manure?
Yeah, it's horse manure, and then on top of horse manure.
Straw?
Okay, straw.
Which you're hoping is weed-free?
Hopefully.
Yeah. And then another layer of manure, or then?
No, I think we have dirt that we're placing over there.
And at the moment, I'm talking to Tyler, right?
Taylor. Yeah.
I blow it with names regularly, as Kareen will tell you. So where does the dirt come from?
I have no idea.
He has no idea.
Everybody here knows.
It's beautiful.
Been stuck over here.
Yeah? Are you related to one of these people? Is that how you got dragged into this?
Well, Kareen is my dad's girlfriend.
Okay.
So, sort of. Pretty much.
So you're creating a soil layer here that's going to be actually only, once it compacts, about 6 inches thick with the cardboard, which will eventually decay.
Right, and that's what we're hoping. It'll decay, and as you grow stuff in it, it's going to break down, and then it's going to get through to the other soil
the plants you plant here. But in the meantime, the cardboard will prevent the weeds from coming up in that first year. So, I love that. Yep.
Exactly. Yep.
So for the first year, your plants will have less depth, but they'll also have the manure at its freshest and most nutrient rich, right?
And hopefully we'll have plenty of compost built up over the winter to put on here in spring.
Where are you getting the compost, or what are you building that up from?
Our house scraps, and then I'm starting to bring home scraps from work, too.
Uh-huh.
So,
where do you work?
The Daily.
So you are at a coffee bar where they have food scraps that you can
make use of. Yeah, I make the burritos there, so I bring home, like, hundreds of eggshells. So.
Amazing to see somebody watering after we've just had 2 days of rain. But, but here you are watering down the straw. Boy, it smells so good. It's so fresh.
It does.
Well, the good thing about the rain, too, that we had is it moistened up everything below.
Right.
Which, when you're sheet mulching, you'd want to do anyway. So,
and sheet mulching means putting down layers of mulch, correct?
It's also known as lasagna gardening.
Yes.
And what it is putting down a layer. Usually you start with a layer of high in nitrogen, like manure, or your kitchen scraps. Then you put cardboard, and then you put another layer of nitrogen, then straw, then soil.
Right.
And then usually straw on top of that.
Right. Huh. So what is going to happen? We've been talking exclusively at this point about all the stuff on the south side of this long bed. The bed runs north-south. And here at the end of the garden beds, closest to where the central path is, the steps that go down to the yard, you've got what I think must be a keyhole.
Right. I'm shaping up a keyhole garden bed, which is basically the curve of the bed is south-facing, so it can act as a solar trap. And again, it's a space-saving type of garden bed.
So the opening faces south. One approaches, one walks in from the south towards the north. And the garden bed then is, if you walk into it, it looks exactly like a keyhole. If you walk into the round area, there are garden beds on your right, your left, the east and the west, and straight ahead on the north side.
Right.
Okay.
And the design is another permaculture design where you put the stuff that you are most often, you know, you're clipping your garlic chives, your chives, your lettuce right around the edge.
Closest to the keyhole itself.
And then you'd put, like, you're plucking vegetables like your chard and your kale a little bit further away.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, you would put
on the outside.
Right. Well, and then on the way outside, you put things that you don't have to look at very often. Now, in this context of this design, that might not necessarily be the case, but in other designs, you could put corn on the very back, or squash, or something like that.
Because it's tallest?
Well, one, because it's tallest, so it would act as a solar trap, but two, because it's furthest away from you relative to the keyhole bed, so you wouldn't be looking at it as often.
Not looking at it. I don't understand what looking at it.
Or attending it.
It wouldn't need as much tending.
Yeah.
Well, if it did, you could get at it from the outside.
In this design, yes.
But sometimes there's a wall there or the house or whatever.
Yeah.
Got it. This one happens to be open.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, when you came to my house, you mentioned that some of my beds looked sort of like a keyhole, but they didn't actually have the round extension.
In the middle.
And the reason for that was that I tried to make mine wide enough. Help, here comes a wheelbarrow for a wheelbarrow. and I didn't want the wheelbarrow to be hitting things on the edges.
Right.
But if you're planting just very small things on the edges,
then it's okay.
Then it's not a problem.
Right.
Aha, I think I can make my beds wider.
Yeah. Over here we got the herb spiral.
Right, and I had no idea what you meant when you first mentioned that you were going to build one. And it's much nicer than anything I'd imagined, and I want one. It is indeed a spiral. Okay, you could imagine a giant snail shell, which means maybe 6 or 7 feet wide. Is that about right?
Probably about 6 feet.
Yeah, 6 feet.
It looks like scrap bricks, rocks, and pieces of cement. These are laid out, so I gather you started by making a large, almost circle with these materials. And then instead of, as it came around towards the starting point, instead of letting it just meet that, you started curling inwards and building it higher and higher. So it's what? About 1.5 turns not really all that many. And then all that inside area is planted with, or sorry, is filled with a beautiful dirt. Now, is there a particular purpose to this aside from aesthetics?
Absolutely. It's actually one of the quintessential permaculture examples.
A quintessential? Oh,
yes.
Well, in that case.
Exactly.
Let's all put upon our respectful permaculture hats and bow. Okay,
and
then.
The reason for that is, one, that it takes advantage of the rock as a heat sink.
Oh, yes, of course.
And it creates all sorts of different microclimates in a very small space.
So that instead of just having rock around the outside, which would provide the thermal heating only on the outside, mm-hmm. you've got it curling right through the center, and therefore it's providing warmth all the way
right.
down the center of it. That's brilliant!
Right.
I love it!
That's one reason. And then the second, another reason is that it's, you know, you'd see on from the top here, you'd put your...
Which is a very warm area because it's warm, it's south-facing, and it's
right.
got, it's really surrounded by rock.
Right. So you put things like thyme and oregano.
Which want lots of sun.
Exactly. Whereas here on the north-facing side.
Which is a little bit shaded by that highest wall.
Right. You'd put things like chives and parsley and things that don't need as much. So and then as it goes down progressively, you'd have like the cooler, moister,
right.
you know, shade-loving,
right.
wetter plants right there.
I'm going to build one.
Yeah.
Did you know the central, the round area in my garden?
Right.
Is where I have my herbs.
Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah.
this would be a wonderful addition.
And this could not only be culinary herbs, of course, it could be medicinals. And of course, it could also be just vegetables.
Right.
Too.
Right. And
want,
again, you could use it for the different types.
Microclimates.
Right. That's
yeah.
marvelous.
Yeah. So that's, and it's great because we use this concrete block that was in the back there that we found.
To build it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we didn't
just
really...
bits of concrete.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
Found materials.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But the whole thing is just very nice. So what is going to happen over here on the north side, which would be shadier because you've got...
Yeah,
what kind of a tree is this?
Two cherry trees.
Two cherry trees.
And were you picking cherries?
Yeah,
we made jam this year.
That's great.
This will be our control area to see how the she mulching does. We're going to try and get some... manure and some sand and till it into this area and then grow.
But
like,
not sheet mulch it.
Not sheet mulch it, but then try and grow like kale and chard and spinach and stuff over there that will do better with
more shade tolerance.
More shade tolerance.
Right.
Stuff.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, because it looks like you will have some significant weeds that are going to be trying to make a comeback here.
Yeah. There'll
yeah.
be thistles and other stuff.
Oh, thistles. Oh, Lord. Oh. So the result here is... Let's see, four long beds, each of them a good 3 to 3.5 feet wide. Taylor's
yeah,
shrugging.
Four.
3 to 4? Okay.
Yeah.
With maybe a 2-foot path
yeah.
open between each of those.
Yeah.
And then at the north end of those, we've got the keyhole and the herb spiral. It's beautiful. And it's almost done.
It's almost done.
You guys are running late, though. It's 5:30. I'm sorry. I'm going to cancel your subscription. Okay.
Almost there.
When I left a few minutes later, it was done, and Karine was bringing out a home-baked pie. This week's gardening tip, delivered at lightning speed because this show is already running over long, is to adapt Karine's cardboard mulch as a way to handle recalcitrant weeds. If you lay down a layer of either 12 to 20 pieces of newspaper or a single thickness of cardboard and leave it in place and build soil up on top of it, you will find that most bad weeds will be defeated. Even creeping bellflower is simply non-existent after 3 years under this mulch, and by that time, both mulch and bellflower roots will have degraded. Good luck with that, and good gardening.
An old crow watching hungrily from his perch in yonder tree. In my garden, I'm as free as that feathered thief up there. Up there.